This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We hear there are a few people who rather dread the approach of the November election this year. So we'll give those people a break and talk about a past election. The midterm elections of 1994, in the middle of President Bill Clinton's first term, wiped out Democratic control of Congress and put the House in Republican hands for the first time in 40 years. Newt Gingrich took national stage as Speaker of the House. Our guest writes about that major election, but in a fictionalized account. Oregon author Jack Miller's book is 1994, A Novel of Politics. Jack Miller is an assistant professor in the Politics and Global Affairs Department at Portland State University. He's been teaching political philosophy and American politics here and around the world, including in the likes of Azerbaijan, for 30 years. Jack Miller, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here.
So your dedication in 1994 is to your students. In a sense, did they prompt the writing of the book?
Well, the reason I actually wrote this book sort of just very pragmatically was that I was teaching a class in politics and fiction for a couple of years over the summer, and it was really easy to find political fiction on the screen, movies and television shows of all kinds. The landscape of contemporary political novels is pretty thin, and so I thought that I would fill that hole and be able to produce a piece of work that my students could read and that we could analyze. I also teach classes in American politics and particularly in electoral politics, and I thought, well, I could actually use this also as kind of a vehicle for showing people in a very concrete way how it is that campaigns look from the inside, which is not something that we typically get depicted very, I think, accurately either in the, you know, the news media or in fictional media. So that was the kind of background for why I wrote the book.
I'm curious about you saying that the shelf of contemporary novels about American politics is thin. Is that because truth is stranger than fiction of late?
Yeah, I think that politics doesn't necessarily make for such a great landscape of novel. And maybe it's just that the lane of political fiction is so successfully taken up with television shows and movies that novelists don't necessarily feel like they can compete in that. I'm not really sure why. I mean, I looked around for books in pretty much primary colors, which was published in the 90s, was about the only thing that I could find. There are some satires that didn't really suit my purpose. So it's not as though there's no political fiction. It's just that, especially compared to television and movies, it's a pretty thin domain.
Given that, did you have to approach this novel to kind of move away from the likes of Primary Colors and The West Wing and that genre?
Well, you know, I wanted to make my book as realistic as possible, just in terms of what I know about how politics really goes. And at the same time, and this was part of what I was teaching my students in the politics and fiction class, I had to think about an audience. I had to think about entertainment. I had to think about a good plot line that was going to keep people reading and to not essentially just make it a fictionalized version of a textbook. That was not at all what I wanted to do. And so there were places where I had to choose between my professorial side and my novelist side in terms of like, well, this isn't necessarily the most realistic thing that would happen, but I need an interesting plot twist, or I need something juicy that's going to keep the reader engaged. But that is what all political fiction has to do. Television show, whether it's a satire or a serious show like West Wing, there's a balance between depicting politics the way it actually happens and depicting it the way that an audience will connect with.
Well, 1994 certainly provides lots of fodder. It was a very interesting election for some of the reasons we already listed here, but were there fairly easy pickings for an avenue to take here?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, this particular race that I focused on, which is an Ohio Senate race, is based on an actual race in Ohio between a television lawyer who I remembered from my childhood, a guy named Joel Hyatt. He's the inspiration for the Democratic candidate because he actually ran for the open seat in the Senate in 1994 that was being vacated by his father-in-law. And he runs against the sitting lieutenant governor of Ohio at the time. And so I changed the names and I changed the personalities a little bit, but there was a race between a high-profile TV lawyer who was, in a way, Democratic Party royalty, because his father-in-law had been a senator for 20 years, and a sitting lieutenant governor, a kind of a perfect political story to tell. And so I just set it right there, and then I fictionalized what it looked like from the ground.
Yeah, it was a very interesting set of circumstances. I did go look at the actual race to see how closely you were hewing to the real world, and fairly closely. We should point out, too, that the Republican who won that Senate race, Mike DeWine, is currently the governor of Ohio.
Right. And, yeah, I knew pretty close to the polling and the eventual outcome. I did, because of the Internet, I was able to watch television footage of the primary debates as well as the general election debates. the internet gave me a chance to go back in a time machine and see not a ton of stuff, but I was able to see a decent amount of that coverage that happened during at the time. Of course, in 1994, there was no internet, so I didn't either have to or get to represent the internet's impact on elections in this particular book. But the internet aided in my research greatly, for sure.
Yeah,
it was fun to be able to see a bygone era and to visually see the connections and the differences between the present and the 30 years ago past.
The book is called 1994, A Novel of Politics, by our guest Jack Miller, who teaches at Portland State University. Melissa Carnes is the first of your characters that we meet. She works for the Democratic National Committee, and she's aware of some shortcomings in that season and the Democratic approach to elections. What are those?
Well, she knew, as most Democrats knew in 1994, that it was potentially going to be a red wave election. First midterm elections for presidents are traditionally a loss for the president's party. 1994 was also an interesting election in terms of campaign strategy, that when the book starts in mid-September had just become, front page news that the Republicans were running on a specific national legislative campaign known as the Contract with America. And political junkies will remember the Contract with America. Other people might have heard of it, but it was a change in the way that parties ran for legislative seats. Prior to 1994, both the Democratic and the Republican Party focused their campaign efforts on local issues, local candidates, and the idea that all politics is local really was the prevailing wisdom on how to run campaigns. Newt Gingrich and his team of House Republicans, who were aiming to take over the House for the first time in 40 years, and they succeeded in doing so, came up with a different playbook, and that playbook has been used ever since. And that playbook was to have a nationalized campaign. All of your candidates in your party would run on that, as well as on local issues and local name recognition. But Mel knows that this is the playbook that's being run, and it's by the time the book starts in mid-September, the Democrats who are running campaigns throughout the country are already aware of how successfully this new playbook is going to be. In fact, the Republicans exceeded the traditional expectation of how well they would do in a first presidential midterm. They pretty much doubled the number of seats flipped in the House, and they tripled the number of seats flipped in the Senate for the 60-year average of the 60 years prior to that. So it was a very successful strategy on the part of the Republicans.
And I wonder, it seems like you got fictionalized characters, obviously, and fictionalized circumstances and conversations, but it seems like the political part of this, you played pretty straight.
Well, yeah, I'm a political science professor, and so I didn't want to distort the way politics go. And as I said earlier, one of my purposes was to write a semi-educational work of fiction that would give people a real picture of what politics actually looks like, with, of course, those fictionalized aspects that make it an exciting read. But I appreciate you saying that it seems to have hewed close to reality, because that was my intention all along. And the 1994 election and the election in Ohio really were, it was just, in terms of historical fiction, it really, I won't say it wrote itself, but it really helped to write itself, the real history.
Well, and again, the real history certainly provides some reminders of things and attitudes and people. You know, that election, like any, created heroes and villains on the way to Election Day. Mel's boss at the Democratic National Committee talks about Hillary Clinton, who was then the first lady, and uses an adjective I'll skip. It reminded me to ask the question of pretty much any political scientist who was alive at that time. How did Hillary get to be such a target in the Bill Clinton White House?
Well, I think that, there was a lot of sexism in politics back then, more so than even today. And today there's still a lot. I think that, Hillary was always a lightning rod for criticism because she decided to step out of the traditional mode of the first lady and really be a political activist. One of the things that she did during the first half of Clinton's first term was took the lead on the healthcare reform initiative. And she was the real sort of force behind the bill, the healthcare reform bill that failed. And that is kind of seen as a political debacle. So she stepped into a political arena far different from what most first ladies would engage in. And so she put herself into the kind of limelight that normally only elected officials would occupy. Because she was a first lady and not the president, and because she was a woman in a still pretty sexist political system, that put extra targets onto her back. And the gender double standard that she faced in, she faced it in the 2016 presidential election is is an underlying theme in the book. I chose to make the main character of this book a woman in politics, and I wanted to depict, among other obstacles for any political operative, what a woman functioning in the political system would face that was more challenging than a man would face. And so, you know, Hillary was just she was probably the first high-profile woman to just really come into the teeth of this ugly double standard that women in politics face. But it's something that all women who've been in politics know, that you almost can't do it right. If you're too calm, then you're a robot. If you're too passionate, then you're angry or you're emotional. I would say that Hillary has had to carry that problem with her for her entire political career, starting in the early 1990s.
Jack Miller's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of 1994, a novel of politics about the election of, you guessed it, 1994. There's plenty of interesting stuff that comes from the characters, and if you can open up page 37, I'd like you to read this great paragraph you wrote, coming out of the mouth of a Republican campaign manager, Howard the Shark Kane.
Son, being a Republican is the only way you can be utterly ruthless. People value that in a Republican. They expect it. It smacks of competitiveness, frontiersmanship, results. Republican candidates, they'll let you do pretty much whatever you want as long as you get them a win. Democrats, not so much. Democrats want to be ruthless, but they have to tiptoe around it. Look like they care about the little guy, about principles and civility. You run the campaign of a Republican and you don't always have to take off the gloves at any point, because the gloves are always off, right from the get-go.
Thanks for the accent, too. Howard the Shark Kane, the character of Jack Miller in 1994. Did you actually hear something like this? Is this your own analysis coming out of his mouth?
Well, you know, I went to college in Washington, D.C. in the late 80s, and I studied philosophy and history, but I was around a lot of people who were studying not just political science, but political communication. And I had a lot of friends who were Republicans. In fact, it was a time in America when Democrats and Republicans hung out together all the time, drank beers together. I did hear these kinds of things from my Republican friends, and I have heard similar things along the many years that I've been studying politics since then. So the things that the characters say in the book are pretty much amalgams of things that I've heard said by political operatives throughout my entire time studying and analyzing politics. So Howard Kane's exact speech didn't ever come out of anybody's mouth, but those ideas for sure have. And I do know that Democrats particularly often complain that it's harder to be a Democratic political operative because playing hardball is offensive to some people in the Democratic coalition, that being civil and respectful is part of the culture that is expected of Democrats. And Republicans have a different version of civility and respect, but being hardball is baked into the way Republican political strategists know that they can do things. They're not going to get pushback from the candidate who's going to say, no, I'm not going to go on TV and say that thing.
Let me give you one more question before we hit a break in about a minute, and that's about something you just mentioned about how operatives used to hang out together. This was something major that changed in 1994 and has stayed changed, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And, you know, one of the things I've heard stories from people who were in D.C. in 1994 and 1995 after the Republicans took over, and one of the things that did change was that the House Republicans essentially said to their people, we don't want you talking to groups and organizations, lobbyists, pollsters that aren't Republican aligned. And so what was maybe a sort of informal separation of the two parties became like the official way that things were done. Another thing that happened in 1994, or actually in 95, once the Republicans took over the House, that is kind of hidden inside politics, is that Newt Gingrich reduced the legislative calendar to a three-day work week. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday was going to be the legislative week. And what that meant was that members of Congress had more time to go home, and in fact, Newt encouraged them to go home, to stay connected to their constituents so they could win re-election, to raise money. And what has become the norm now is that members of Congress don't move their families to Washington, D.C. They used to move their families to Washington, D.C. because they spent most of their time in D.C. and would get home when they could during legislative breaks, but not on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And when your family lives in Washington, D.C., and your members of Congress from whatever party are, you know, essentially inviting each other to their barbecues and their soccer games, there's a kind of a connection and a collegiality that, you know, makes those members of Congress see each other as human beings.
Right.
When you don't move your family to D.C. and you don't socialize and you don't have those kind of interconnections, there's a sort of informal loosening of that camaraderie. And that has definitely been one of the biggest changes. And 1994 was really specifically a time when that cleavage began. And it is just, you know, thoroughly familiar to us now. But it began at that exact time.
Jack Miller, our guest. His book, 1994, A Novel of Politics. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're talking about politics, but not in a real present tense. In fact, not even in the real world. We do get a lot of real world details in Jack Miller's book, 1994, but it is also a novel of politics in which we look at the Gingrich wave election of 1994 from an insider's perspective. The insider is Melissa Carnes, a Democratic operative sent by the Democratic National Committee to help on an election for the Senate in Ohio. Jack Miller fictionalized the characters in that race, but otherwise he was pretty closely to what goes on in an election season in 1994, A Novel of Politics. So Jack, Mel Carnes, you know, knows pretty much from September on when the book starts that Newt Gingrich is going to end up Speaker of the House after this Republican wave in 94. What does Mel think of him?
You know, I don't ever bring Newt specifically into the book, but I think that she, as a lifelong Republican and as a person with, you know, a liberal persuasion, I think she sees him as a threat to the future of America, just like a lot of Democrats did. She knew, as you say, that the Republicans were probably going to take the House of Representatives. She's on a Senate race, and the Republicans needed to flip 8 Senate seats that year to take control of the Senate, which was a long shot. They did manage to flip exactly 8 seats, and so they were able to accomplish that. Her job in the book, as the political strategist's real job in the 1994 elections were, was to try to limit Republican gains. And so she, if she was able to pull off a long-shot win in her race, could have actually kept the Democratic majority in the Senate, which would have changed the political dynamics that Bill Clinton would have faced. If he had a Democratic Senate and a Republican House, it would have been very different than if then facing a fully Republican-controlled Congress. So I didn't bring Newt Gingrich into the book specifically because I didn't necessarily want to be making any kind of commentary on him in general. I just kind of, or him specifically, I really wanted to be more of a general, here's a Democrat trying to face down a red wave election, and how do you use that kind of political landscape to increase the drama of what was going on.
Did writing Melissa Carnes' thoughts help you get a few things off your own chest?
It's I would say so. One of the things that I included in this book that isn't strictly political, though I do think it is a common thing in the political arena, is Melissa is torn. Mel is torn about what she's up to. She's a complex person who wants to win, who wants her political party to succeed. She also wants to do the right thing. She wants to make the world a better place. She wants to be happy. She wants to honor her parents' legacy. She wants to maybe have a family someday and have a non-crazy lifestyle. So Mel is a person with complex inner dynamics. And in a way, there's a power struggle within her to control her actions and her words. I find that this is true in a lot of people who go into politics. I've been studying it for 3 decades and talked to a lot of people who do it. Politicians have this image from the outside as being these kind of ruthless, almost robotically ruthless operators. Everybody I've ever known in politics has a conscience, and their conscience doesn't always win, but it's always wrestling. Everybody in politics has certain kinds of aspirations and goals that they, you know, if you're in politics for any amount of time, you realize that you're never going to get everything you want. And so you're going to have to accept half measures. You're going to have to accept frustrations. So everybody who is in politics has an inner struggle between essentially their idealistic side and their pragmatic side, between their personal goals and their professional goals. And I'm a person like that as well. Anyone who's sufficiently complex, and I think most human beings, if not every single human being, is quite complex in this, in their inner world. So it did help me to work through my own relationship to things like, okay, you want to make the world a better place. How willing are you to play hardball to do that? Or how often do you have to give up the perfect for the good? When is it the right thing to maybe disengage from things that are important to you to preserve your own sanity? In the end, I'm not sure that Mel taught me how to think through these better, but she did give me the experience of getting to go through it in a way that, it wasn't my personal set of struggles, but it was realistic enough that I think that I gained some better understanding of the world by doing it. And I hope the readers gain a similar understanding of their own inner struggles from reading this book as well.
Well, inner struggles and the things they do, you know, because the campaign tactics she has to use here. As Mel goes further into strategy in the book, you're basically reminding us that lots of things get candidates elected or not, and it seems like policies are rarely much of it.
Yeah, that's another thing I think that people think that politics is about policy. It's campaign is particularly about storytelling, and it's actually one of the reasons why I think it was kind of nice for me to be able to write a story about a storyteller. Human beings react to narratives. We react to story. We are much more likely to be swayed by emotions, and story is a better carrier of emotion than policy arguments are. So that's one of the things that I hope that people learn from this book is when you look deep inside the campaign, what are the strategists actually thinking about? They're focusing on what story is our campaign telling to the voters, and how can we get the voter to see themselves essentially as the hero of the story, that at the end of that story, they vote for my candidate and they live happily ever after. You know, it's a little more complex than that, but that's the basic narrative structure of any campaign is here's a story. I have a character and a landscape, and you, the voter, vote for our person, and your life is better. Then there's a lot of technical side of like how you figure out what the contours of the story will be, what will reverberate. That's where polling and focus grouping comes in. But fundamentally, Mel is a storyteller, and every successful political candidate is telling us a story about the world that they hope that we will enroll ourselves in and vote for them.
Jack Miller from Portland State University, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book we're talking about is 1994, A Novel of Politics. So speaking of the story being told here, I do love the moment when Melissa Carnes first meets the candidate, Kyle Porter, and just thinking, what raw material?
Yeah, he's essentially an entrepreneurial lawyer, as the real character I based him on is Joel Hyatt. And she recognizes in him that he's an actor. And if you are a campaign manager or campaign strategist, you don't get to control the personality of your candidate. You can shape it. You can move it in whatever direction you think you need to. But the candidate is often the biggest stumbling block for campaign strategists. And she's just thrilled that she has somebody who looks like he not only has the desire to, follow her script, but that he actually has the acting chops to pull it off as well. He is, in a way, the perfect candidate, like, in that way. That is modeled after a lot of what I have heard about Ronald Reagan, is that, he was literally an actor, but it was that Ronald Reagan was, as an actor, he was kind of a B-movie actor, but as a politician, he could be a grandfather, he could be a businessman, he could be a compassionate human being, he could be a tough negotiator, he could be a strong commander-in-chief. He can play a lot of roles. And in this book, Mel recognizes in her candidate that he has the Reagan chops to be able to play whatever role he'll look good in a hard hat, he'll look good in a three-piece suit, he'll look good in a police vest, and he'll be able to carry them all off comfortably. That's not the case. For me personally, if I were running for office and you put me in a three-piece suit, I would be a little awkward. If you put me in a hard hat, I would feel like a poser. If you put me in a police vest out fly fishing, I would feel out of sorts. I only have one or two places that I can go where I feel perfectly authentic. Kyle Porter is capable of feeling authentic in a variety of different places. And from the point of view of campaign strategy, that's really ideal because that's how you connect with people. You make yourself seem like they can recognize themselves in you. The more flexible you are in your presentation, And the more you can do that authentically, because people can, human beings, Americans, we can smell a fraud. You know, you put me in a fly fishing outfit and I'm not going to be able to pull it off. I showed a John Kitzhaber ad one time in one of my campaign classes where he was in a fly fishing outfit. And I had been assured by the campaign people who had loaned me that ad that he really was a fly fisherman. And the reason why he looked so comfortable in his waders in the river was that that was something that he genuinely did. So that is, like, some people can pull off authenticity in places that they don't normally go, and other people can't. And I think that's one thing that people think, that all politicians are just great actors, but that varies a lot. And Mel is very pleased that she's landed somebody who has those chops.
So let's talk about, though, the general mood. I mean, because things are so much against the Democrats in September of 1994. It's kind of like a funeral with the death not having happened yet. I mean, how do candidates and political operatives keep going even when the cause appears almost certainly lost?
Well, you know, the thing about democracy is it keeps happening over and over. Election cycles, you know, this is one of the frustrations people have. They're like, oh, my God, the last election was just over and the next one's coming up. That's what democracy is supposed to be. And when you're an insider, you know that. And so part of what Mel's purpose in this election is, like, of course you want to win. But when you can't win, you are looking to the future. And at one point in the book, she does say to the campaign manager, like, look, this guy doesn't want to get destroyed by 18 points. She comes into the race, he's 18 points down in the polls. If he loses by 18 points, his political career is done. Before it even gets started. If we can narrow this to 5 or 6 points, then maybe he runs again for a House seat, or he runs for governor, or he runs for a Senate seat again in 6 years or so. The same thing is true for political operatives. You know, they're going to get hired onto another campaign in the future. If you do well, even in defeat, then your resume is going to look okay. If you get parachuted into a lost cause and you lose, but you lose less badly than was expected, then you've demonstrated that you have some kind of political skill. So there is that, like, what is the motivation when you know that you're going to lose and that election day is going to be a rout for you? The motivation is that elections keep coming at you in the future, and everyone has an interest in furthering their future career. And there's also just pride. You know, people who work in politics, it's grueling, it's tiring, it can be often very brutal schedule and just emotionally brutalizing. To keep going, you have to be telling yourself, like, this is for a reason. There's a sense in which keeping up the team spirit, the morale, is important in campaign leaders, and Mel is definitely a leader who wants to make sure that her people don't get dissuaded from continuing on. They don't lose their morale until the election is over.
All right, got about a minute left to ask this question about nasty periods in American history. And 1994 certainly was that, and some of the things that started then have stayed. I mean, is this period in American history particularly long-lasting, this level of discord in American politics?
Well, you know, we're 30 years into this particular era, and the previous political era of Democratic dominance lasted from 1932 to 1994, so roughly double the amount of time we've been in. Previous periods of ugliness lasted 2 and sometimes 3 decades, so, you know, we're starting to push the envelope on longer than the historical average, and I would say that it doesn't seem like the divisiveness and the polarization and the ugliness of our current era are really tapering off. It seems like, you know, if I were going to make a prediction, I would say, well, maybe 10 years from now. So, yeah, if it feels like it's been a long time, historically, it is, in fact, a pretty long time.
Well, what the book offers, though, is a chance to sort of relive the history, but through some fictional characters, and you can get in their heads in ways you couldn't if this had been a straight nonfiction book. It is called 1994, A Novel of Politics, by Jack Miller, who's an assistant professor in the Politics and Global Affairs Department at Portland State University. Jack, thanks so much for sharing this with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me on. It was great talking about the book.
And that's it for today's Exchange. Find this and all JX interviews at jeffexchange.org. Angela Decker from JPR News is senior producer. Student Charlie Zimmerman is assistant producer. Zach Beagle is our other student engineer. Maxwell and Terry Longshore composed our theme music. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Take care and have a great day.